Collegiate Vision Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark, where we acknowledge we now live in a world transformed by the ongoing, unstoppable nuclear disaster in Fukushima, Japan. Our goal is to inspire our listeners to face this truth with courage and determination to thrive beyond disaster. Each morning, Monday through Thursday, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, we interview activists and victims of toxic contamination in order to expose the inequity and injustice of a system built on profit over life that views humans as assets on a balance sheet. We interview healers and innovators who are leading the way for humanity to reclaim our right to a healthy life, real liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage by taking action to save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Your actions matter. Your voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. We are happy to resist. Love is greater than fear. Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. This is a pre-recorded interview. We decided to take advantage of some news and get an interview going pretty quickly. This is June 27th, 2017. I connected with my guest, Sean McGee, who, as you know, is a reporter on nuclearnews-net and also the reporter for the European reporter for Nuclear Hot Seat. I connected with him through Facebook to do an interview about news that I read this morning about Chernobyl. So thanks, Sean, for joining us on the last minute. I hope that we can get this up pretty quickly. Thanks for sharing your time with us.
Sure, no worries. It's good to be back again, Lonnie.
Well, this was interesting because here in the States, the thing that... Actually, there was no news in the States. Reuters did not report it. I was doing some digging around. There was a story this morning about the internet hacking that's going on all over Europe, like the Ukraine and all over. And I was talking to my friend Ed, and he's like, you know that Chernobyl's on manual. And I'm like, no, he reads all the European news. There's an online newspaper called Verge, and they reported that Chernobyl's on manual. That's a pretty serious thing, isn't it, having Chernobyl be on manual?
Okay, well, look, I think what the actual story is, as far as I could work out, is that the actual virus has attacked their... the online new radiation monitoring system, and that's actually connected to something called EURDEP, which is the European radiation monitoring system. So I don't know if the whole system is affected, but we do know that the Chernobyl one is. It's been shut down. Now the actual attack itself, it started in Russia, where this particular virus, it's the Petya ransomware, it's called. This virus basically, last time it attacked Russia the worst, and this time it's attacked Russia, but it's also hit Ukraine, and it's hit countries all around Europe as well. You know, obviously side issues of it. Here in Ireland, one of our major shipping companies were basically affected as well, and probably because Ireland's sort of a hub of you know, Google and Facebook and what have you, they've got a lot of internet companies here dodging the tax, I might point out.
Well, do you think it affected other nuclear power plants in the Ukraine and around the Soviet Union also?
Well, it's probably affected sort of. Well, what it has done is it's affected the monitoring system. So that's, you know, you've got a similar thing. Is it RadNet or something in America?
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. So that's actually been hacked. That's one of the things that's ended up with this ransomware.
Well, now, the funny thing about the story that I read on Verge about Chernobyl, it said that the monitoring, that the workers were being inspected manually in and out, and everything else was working the same as usual, which I read into meaning that they're not really checking for radioactivity, they're just checking the workers.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're running around with sort of their own Geiger counters. Now, obviously, Ukraine and Russia, they're quite, especially that part of the world, they do have their own sort of Geiger counters. So, you know, bottom line is, I think at the moment, I've just gone onto Eurodep, and let me see, I'm just going to check Ukraine. And it's only got one monitoring station running on the European Eurodep. I've just clicked on it just to see what it's going to say. We've got Kiev. So there's one in Kiev that's working, but all the other ones have been knocked off. So it sounds like the whole of Ukraine has actually been knocked off, not just the Chernobyl one. And let me just... But Kiev one is still running, in theory. So I'm just going to check out... Belarus has got its normal spike, and let me just check something here. Polyline,
and you call that Eurodep, EURDEP,
EURDEP, and you can access it on the internet as well. So that's interesting. So what's going on there? Okay, well, I mean, Chernobyl, Belarus, on the just on the other side of the border, Belarus. It's reading 0.56 microsieverts per hour. So probably a little bit higher, possibly, than it normally is. When was the last time? So it's the 27th of June, this morning, and it's not reporting anything since. But they're only doing one reading a day, by the look of it, just to obfuscate things. Now, I could actually say something about the radiation mapping generally. In Europe, you know, and it was sort of underpinned by the, I don't know if you've seen my ArcLight 2011 YouTube channel, but I did a series of we talked about it as well, a series of videos about the Halden, Norway's Halden research reactor, which did a couple of emissions. They've only admitted to one, but we reckon there's more than one. And we noticed that there was certain problems with the Eurodep mapping system, trying to get information from it. In the past, I've had problems, I think it's the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, who have some sway over the Eurodep mapping system, that they will switch off whole countries. Monitoring system when they think that there might be a release that might be spotted by this system. So they'd actually just switch the whole country off, like all of France's radiation mapping will go off and so on and so on. But looking at it at the moment, most of the other countries do seem to be operating okay. We can't tell a lot about what's going on. Belarus is still running, so that's not been hit. Ukraine, the monitoring systems are down there, but Kiev is still running. That's one monitor. It's a very large country, but that's the nearest one to the Chernobyl area.
Think that will affect the tracking of these things also?
Well, to be honest, the IAEA does their own sort of messing around with the tracking of these things. So it's quite interesting that their internet's being sort of messed with. But at the end of the day, what they've done is they've basically had old Windows systems Windows systems that are affected by this. Specifically, things like Windows XP. The nuclear industry doesn't like spending money on anything it doesn't need to. So they just use the old sort of software that they've got and keep it running. Now, obviously, Edward Snowden, we talked about him, he's put a tweet out And it says that NSA government kept open the hole, Eternal Blue, hit by today's hashtag Pettier, hashtag not Pettier, ransomware attack for more than 5 years. And he's linked to a Washington Post article. I don't know if that's one that's happened now, but the bottom line is though, obviously the NSA, you know, if you're looking at it, Russia, Ukraine, most of Europe, you know, various computers in Europe, it's hitting all the Windows systems. It doesn't surprise me that American media isn't covering this, because it wouldn't be good for Windows, would it? You know, Microsoft. Microsoft have aided and abetted in keeping these back doors into their systems. And in fact, actually looking wider, about, I think it was in 2014, Chris Busby's bank account was hacked.
Yeah, I remember that. Do you think that this is... Do you think that these types of attacks, these cyber attacks, and affecting the... I mean, they have to know this affects the nuclear power facilities, right?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it's a bit like... if we're saying who did this, and we know that there's very little reporting in America about it, and we know that the NSA and affiliated organizations, CIA, have their own version of this as well, obviously, viruses that they send out to different countries. Now, in this case, we're presuming that the NSA have sent out this one to Russia, because Russia was the worst one hit when we had the earlier attack. Was it the end of last year, start of this year? The end of last year, I think. Mm-hmm. And Russia was much worse hit than any other country. I went on it live to see, and Russia just kept coming up. Other countries got hit as well, because there's always spillover, because Russia is connected with all these other countries in Europe, because we do business. They're our neighbors, you know. Bottom line is, and of course, there's a lot of Russian people who actually live in Europe as well.
In America, there's a lot of Russian people here.
Well, of course, it's a multinational world, and we have Russian dissidents that are living in the UK, and you know, we have Russian oligarchs living in Ireland.
Is this just about? I mean, this is the thing: the complete disregard for the risk that they're putting people in by making these facilities go manually. This is a huge issue. Do you think they have backup generators that worked when this kind of thing goes down?
I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is just the monitoring systems. Now, I think when they're talking their internal systems, they may be more modern. I mean, they've just done a lot of modern work, and a lot of money's been spent on the sarcophagus. So one would hope
that they have their internal, because all this is run by computer. So if you hack the computer, you pretty much put it on its knees, right? But what you're saying is that they do have some type of a backup operating system that they can use.
Well, they probably have different systems, but certainly the monitoring system was hit, because at the end of the day, they've got old software that's running it, because they're not investing in it, you know. And they try to neglect the monitoring systems, because at the end of the day, if they made the monitoring systems efficient with regular updates, I mean, Belarus, you know, one reading a day, you know, at the moment. Okay, that's in Belarus. Now, Belarus, obviously, they've recently, they were pulled up because they had a go at an AP reporter, because he reported some information that came from the government scientific laboratories showing that there was very high levels of strontium-90 in the milk. Now, they were giving the cows Prussian blue, so the cesium levels were right down. They were very low. But that doesn't stop the strontium-90, which in Chernobyl especially is very high. So the milk, you know, is not healthy to drink. But this gets shipped out, you know, across Europe and possibly the world, you know, because Europe is trying to, and the USA is trying to be nice to Belarus to wean them away from the Russian influence, the geopolitical side of it. But the interesting thing, going back to the virus, is that it goes out, they target Russia with it, you know, because they're, you know, because they've got nothing else to do with all this billions upon billions of pounds of software. So they think, oh, well, we'll attack Russia with it. because Russia isn't doing what we're telling it to, and it spills out all over Europe, you know, and possibly even back to America. But Europe got hit pretty bad. You know, Ukraine, you know, it's got very bad infrastructure issues. So, you know, apart from maybe the sarcophagus bit and maybe other parts, you know, I'm not saying that the computers that run the nuclear power stations can't be hacked. I mean, there's been reports saying that is possible. And these types of softwares, you know, in Iran, they used it to try and damage I can't remember the name of the term at the moment. The actual nuclear processors, that they sent a virus to that, and apparently that was a combination of Israel and America who did that. You know,
yeah, I remember that. And yeah. But this is the thing. Like, yeah, that was an American deal. I mean, this sounds like, you know, I honestly, this is the really bizarre part, especially being in the States, like where we hear how this went. Now, I would love to know who this firm is that was mentioned in this, although they did say Ukraine's electricity supplier said that the power supply was unaffected by the attack. So they did have something on the back end of it, but it affected their banks. It did mention, though, that Chernobyl was on a switch to manual radiation monitoring as a result of the attacks.
That's correct, yeah. So basically, that means they're walking around the Geiger counters, you know, in theory.
Just to make sure, because they don't, just to double check, just to make sure.
Yeah. But I mean, the bottom line is actually, they get, you know, it'd be quite interesting, but you won't be able to know. I mean, see, the thing is, if there was an incident, they'd be told to keep it quiet. And if there was an incident, they'd switch the monitoring stations off anyway. That's kind of my point. Or they wouldn't necessarily switch them off, but they'd stop them, the public, from being able to access them on the public mapping system. So it's kind of in the term of monitoring in Europe, there is a kind of, you know, Eurodep is good sometimes because it gives the game away here and there if you keep an eye on it. And certainly I've kept an eye on it.
Well, tell us about this, man. My brain keeps coming back to this vision, this picture that was in the States about these, I think it was the Belgians locked arm in arm and said, no way to nuclear.
That's right. It's thousands. It was tens of thousands, I think, of people went to Belgium and just locked arm in arm and said, no way, mate. There's some good, I think RT actually did cover it, you know, and RT actually are pretty pro-nuke normally.
Yeah.
But they did actually cover that one. And the Belgian reactors, they've got lots of cracks in them, you know, and it's a very common problem. And the nuclear industry is saying, oh, well, it's not, you know, there's no major problem with it. It's okay. But in reality, of course, it's a problem. And, you know, it's profit. You know, they can't be shutting these down. And, you know, basically the actual reactor vessels are, you know, turning to mush, you know. So I may have overstated that technically, but in reality, of course, they are damaged without a doubt. I can say that. And the nuclear industry has been sort of, they take them offline, they check them out, and they come back and say, well, you know, it's not too bad. You know, it's within tolerances and all this kind of thing. But in reality, it's not what they designed, you know, they were designed for. And of course, these reactors are very old. So, you know,
well, Sean, what's your reaction to Donna Gilmore, who's a guest on my show? She runs San Onofre Safety. Do you know Donna Gilmore's work about the thin cast that we use here in the States?
Oh, the thin cast on reactors, you mean?
Yeah.
I've come across it. I mean, I know Donna, you know, obviously on Facebook.
Well, the reason I ask that is because she uses Europe as a model. Like, she talks about how at least in Europe you guys have these thick casts. At least in Europe, you're regulators.
Oh, I think you're on about the actual spent fuel rod casks.
Yes. But
yeah,
you're talking about
totally. I've done some work with Donna on that. Sorry, yes, I am aware of that, yes.
So, but you're talking about thin, you're talking about different containers then.
This would be, well, I think if we're talking about the spent nuclear fuel rod dry cast containers, you know, because they've got them in these pools that are quite dangerous, so we want them in sort of dry cask sort of containers.
So not all of it is in dry cask containers. Some of it is in like
most of it is in spent fuel pools. You know, in the case of Sellafield, they're just out in the open. They're rusting away. You know. And in a recent report that the Irish EPA did, that you know they didn't really take into account the dangers from the spent fuel pool and possible ramifications for Ireland. They sort of beat about the bush on it. They did a projection, radiation projection across Ireland. But they,
For Sellafield, would you describe that? Because I don't think many people in the United States understand what how big it is. What the problems are. We hear that it's leaking. I learned from Dana Durnford about it that there was, this is what he says, I think he says 9 million liters a day leaking into the Irish Sea or something like that. That's my long-time memory of it that's implanted in my brain. It shocked me.
But, well, I mean, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. But to start off with, you've got, say, in the 70s, there was some heavy pollution that went into the Irish Sea from there because they just dumped it in there. There's a big pushback from Norway and Ireland and other countries as well. And they clamped down on the amount of radiation they were going to release, in theory. So now, in theory, they've cut that down a lot. You know, if you look at the amounts that they've actually cut down, it's a lot. But the contamination is there now. But that doesn't mean they've stopped the contamination. But it has improved. I mean, the thing I was actually looking at, which is a much bigger problem,
How big is this place? How many? What are we?
It's very large. I mean, you know, Hanford. It's kind of I don't know per square meter, but you know, it's that kind of size. Hanford is big.
400, 500 square miles. The whole reservation is huge, and big swaths of it, like huge portions. You know. 100 acre, 200 acre, 300 acres, just huge sections of it have like plutonium fields that used to be closed that are closed, and they're just sort of wastes. They're just where the waste is. Nothing can grow there. It's just a hideous thing.
Well, I mean, Sellafield, there's quite a few thousand people working there, you know, so off the top of my head, I don't know.
Like this place.
But, yeah, absolutely.
I think 6,000 to 8,000, something like that.
And I don't think it's quite as big as Hanford, given those sort of figures. But having said that, though, it is a huge site. And it's got certain large areas that are donated to, nuclear fuel processing, storage of nuclear fuel rods, general nuclear waste. There's a whole huge building that's filled with loads of different types of nuclear waste. Then you've got the Sellafield site itself, which is, you know, doing all sorts of different, you know, bomb manufacturing and all sorts of things. So, or bomb materials manufacturing. So there's the whole area is quite a nasty thing. Now they have been trying to sort it out over these last decades, but you know, I think basically I've done quite a bit of information about it, and there was a recent documentary by BBC, and they turned around and they said, well, look, at the end of the day, the documentary said that the Sellafield were lying to the Parliament when they had a meeting with the Parliament. Now, you know, in theory, you go to jail for that, but the fact is that it was all glossed over. And played down, and of course the Sellafield management hasn't been held to task. Now, if they're doing that sort of thing, if they're lying about to Parliament about possible problems that were occurring at the time, you know, a couple of years ago in Sellafield, then you know, how can you trust anything they say? But we do have some figures, some stats, some readings that say that some things are better. We know also that there's been incidences there, you know, with plutonium dust being blown around. We've seen that in Japan recently as well, which actually got into the bodies of people. And so, you know, at the end of the day, there is quite large issues there, you know. I mean, the plutonium thing, I had a bit of an argument with some nuclear guys, one from America, one from Australia, and one from the UK. The UK one was connected to a guy called Wade Allison. Have you ever heard of him? he's a pro-nuke psycho. But anyway, the bottom line is that I was arguing with these people about the Japanese plutonium release. And they were saying, well, there's 22,000 becquerels of plutonium, and that's hardly, you know, that's hardly anything. And I said, well, actually, what that is, it's a 1.7, I think it is, micron-sized particle of plutonium. That's what that is, 22,000 becquerels that was reported, because everybody thought it was dust everywhere. Or it was many smaller micron-sized particles. Now, the interesting thing about these micron-sized particles, of course, Japan Times came out and said, oh, there's no, they didn't take it in. But these little particles, of course, measuring up to 22,000 becquerels, if it was just one 1.7 micron-sized particle, which would give you 22,000 becquerels, that would actually go through the masks that they were wearing. If it was a smaller particle, if they were getting down to sort of what we call nanoparticles, you know, very small particles, like, you know, 0.05 microns, you know, maybe a few particles like that, they would actually be able to go through the skin, yeah, into the bloodstream. So there was a big issue. You know, first of all, they said that somebody got these 22,000 becquerels in their body. They obviously measured it. And then they came back and said, well, actually, that was a mistake. And then I think a bit later on, somebody said that they found it in the urine of one of the workers. About a week later, they admitted that it was in the urine of one of the workers. But what wasn't discussed was the fact that this was just one tiny little micron-sized particle. Now, of course, going back to Sellafield, when they had their plutonium, it was actually, they have these plastic pots of plutonium powder, and I think one of those got spilled, or some of that got released, and explaining to you the size of the particles being very important to how you get contaminated. It's very hard to measure an alpha emitter when it's in your body, you know. So you can only measure it at the point of entry or the point of exit, like the urine. So at the end, when it's in your body, you know, it's only giving very short gamma bursts. You might get some X-rays where it hits a cell and then creates an X-ray and comes off, but it's very hard to track. You know, we're talking about tiny, tiny, tiny little particles. So. You know, these are the sort of things that the nuclear industry don't want us to talk about, and even when we're getting reports in the press, the journalists that do this reporting don't really explain to us what the issues are. Yeah.
This whole thing about...
Just quickly, I have got a quick update on the Hacker News issue. Okay. From the Hacker News, which is at Hacker News, in case anybody is affected by this, they've got kill switch is found for the hashtag Petya ransomware. And they say just create a file, see Windows, da 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 da. That's actually on Twitter. So at Hackers News. At the Hackers News, sorry.
So you can download an app and...
Well, what it is, they give you some information on how to create a file and solve the problem. So, obviously, social media works a lot quicker than the rest of the media. So
this is where the wars are going also. It's not just killing the bodies. Yeah. They're doing it like just affecting people's, like they're weakening the system so they can go in for the kill. You know what I mean? You weaken your opponent, catch them off guard, and then you have to use less resources to create just as much havoc.
Yeah,
so the thing from Sellafield on Wikipedia says it was the first commercial nuclear power station to generate electricity on an industrial scale.
To make a bomb, basically.
So it was huge. It's a big, gigantic facility.
And at the end of the day, it's all the waste and all the horrible stuff has been building up over time. So it's at the moment I put that as part of my Euratom rejustification, which I sent to the Irish EPA. And that was done by Chris Busby. And we've also, Herve Courtois, he sent one off to the French lot. We've got a few others also that have been sent off. And we're just showing that there's some new information about that proves that there's health effects from much lower doses of radiation. And we sent this out to them. The Irish one is the only one that we've got a response from so far. It was a reasonable response, and they're actually sending it off now for, you know, for the proper process within their department. So somebody's going to have to actually come back and challenge the actual new papers that have been submitted as evidence of a need to re-justify how they measure radiation with dose.
Awesome.
And we're talking, we're talking about internal emitters. And of course, as part of that, I also mentioned about Sellafield, and they did a report, but they talked about a meteorite, worst case scenario, a meteorite hitting it, and then one or two other issues, a plane hitting something. But what they didn't, what they have always refused to do, and in other reports refused to, is to do a terrorist attack on Sellafield. They won't put that into a report because that could be a lot worse than an act of God, if you like. Because at the end of the day, they could target specific areas and cause much more problems.
What does Dr. Busby say?
You know, that could ruin most of the north of the UK or all of Ireland, nearly. So depending on which way the wind was
blowing. The whole of North America. It's like if something happened at Hanford, eventually it just gets to all of North America. Bye-bye. You know what I mean? If they don't...
Well, the biggest issues, and like in Fukushima, are the spent fuel pools. That's the hugest, that's the biggest risk. If they get going, you know, I could be sitting in Ireland here and I could be measuring God knows how many microsieverts per hour with my Geiger counter. You know, if the fuel pool fires started in Japan.
Well, they have had fuel pool fires. We've seen them on YouTube. You can see them. They keep it pretty much under control, but you can see that's what I think they are when you see the fires that erupt there every once in a while. I think
you're on about the videos with steam and stuff. Now, I mean,
no,
sometimes
you can see, I've seen actual the flames, like you can see something's on fire there.
And what you get is you get hydrogen. So say if the fuel rods heat up, they release the hydrogen gas, and the hydrogen gas can catch fire. It can travel as well, and it can catch fire. Now that's one type of issue with a spent fuel pool that you can have.
Okay, so it is the whole... This is the thing, and I think that's why they get freaked out at these fires, because if they don't put it out, it's going to go kablooey. I mean, it's going to get super bad.
With the fuel rods, what it is the heat. So, for instance, the thing that you don't want to get to allow the fuel rod to get near is air. Right. So if the water is boiling off and hydrogen is being produced and all the rest of it, that's a problem in itself. But if the water actually boils off and the fuel rods themselves aren't being cooled by that water and they've got access to the air. And so in Sellafield, for instance, there's no roof, you know, there's no ventilation system to deal with this. It's just the air. So once the air gets to it and the water starts boiling off, the actual rods themselves melt and catch fire, and they start a sustained reaction like you find in a reactor. And of course, they've got these fuel pools absolutely jam-packed with these rods, much more than you'd find in, say, one reactor. Now, this is many reactors' worth of fuel rods. These are the real issues, you know, that we're having to face, and the industry is sort of trying to play down.
Didn't they overpack? I read that they had overpacked those fuel pools with more than what that should have been in there. That's a part of the issue.
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you could probably only get so many in because of the size of the cages, you know, to the size of the fuel pool. But the point is that once they're all full, you know, you get one of those go up, and that's going to be way worse than Chernobyl. Because it's just going to have so much more fuel in there.
Well, don't you think it's already way worse? I think it's already a million times worse. Fukushima is a million times worse than Chernobyl ever was.
Well, I mean, you know, when we quantify it, I tend not to think that. I'm open to seeing more evidence to prove that. But from my contacts in Japan and from the measurements that we see in Europe and in America, we can sort of work out how much was released, you know, and I have to say there's, you know, I don't go with TEPCO's figures on this. I would say there was more released than TEPCO says. And in fact, TEPCO year on year kind of increased the amount that they would admit to, because the evidence really was thrown at them, and they had to kind of admit that there was more.
But Sean, going on a one time. See, Chernobyl wasn't on the edge of the Pacific Ocean. We've had water pouring for 6 years, contaminated high radioactive water going underneath the plants, leaking out into the ocean nonstop. Sure. I mean, it is, that to me, it's not like the, maybe the initial event wasn't as bad as Chernobyl. I didn't look into all the science. I'm just saying, logically, 6 years nonstop on the edge of our lifeblood of our oceans cannot be good. Just like what's going on in Sellafield is harming the Irish Sea, the Atlantic. I actually saw a... this was really one of the turning points for me in my activism in this nuclear reality thing, is I saw a Norwegian doctor or a scientist say, look, I'm Norwegian. You're asking me not to eat the fish. Like, that's asking me not to breathe. Of course we're going to do it. But you know what? As a scientist, I can tell you what, it's like playing Russian roulette with five loaded bullets in there and one open chamber. But that's our reality, and that's what we're going to do.
I mean, as human beings, of course, we have mercury from coal.
Lead. I did an interview today with Heidi Lambert that is actually, and today's date is June 27th. So it doesn't have a title on it because Jules is in the hospital. So from here on out, nothing's going to have a title until she gets better. So so she'll probably be 3 weeks, I would guess, at a minimum. She had a pretty serious thing happen to her. And,
well, we wish her well anyway, I have to say.
Me too, and I think she'll be well. So I think she's going to have surgery, and probably her prognosis is excellent, right? But for a while, we're not going to have titles. But today is June 27th, and Heidi Lambert did this whole interview on, and I would love for you to coordinate with her too, because she grew up in Hanford, and she has understands a lot of what happened with Hanford, and you have the scientific base knowledge that you guys could coordinate, because she's asked me questions, and I think you two could coordinate. But she was talking about the lead, that arsenic ends up, its end result is lead. And we have a lot of lead poisoning here in the States, a lot. It's everywhere. And she was suggesting that because the time where it turns into lead takes about 30 to 40 years, this is why we're seeing it now, because of what happened in the 50s, the 60s, the bombing, the nuke testing bombing. There was, we didn't need World War III. We had it after World War II with the nuke testing.
Well, a lot of the various isotopes that are around, you know, ultimately they will turn to lead, you know, maybe a million years. But when we're doing these processes, we're creating various isotopes that become lead a lot quicker.
That's what she was suggesting. And so, actually, lead is, we know lead is a really bad, and here, but see, I don't know what the lead is like in Europe, but here we're discovering we have lead. This started because of Flint, Michigan, where the water came out copper. People were complaining because their water was copper, and now there's some people going to jail for negligence, and it's a huge catastrophe. We have a big city here who has highly contaminated water to the point where the city has to ship bottled water to people.
Well, Erin Brockovich has done some great work in this area, you know, especially in America. I mean, she's actually been involved with some of the Irish issues with water as well. But I have to say, on this point on lead, you know, I did a study. One of the reasons I got kicked out of the UK, was because I did a study on air pollution. Now, when I first got my Geiger counter, it was September 2011. It was at the end of August I got it. And I put it on, and I was expecting, after Fukushima, I was expecting to get little peaks and all this kind of stuff. And I put it on, and I got very low measurements. My Geiger count was bumping 0.04 microsieverts per hour, you know, up to 0.15 at a maximum, you know, but it was averaging out much lower. And I was kind of disappointed, but also relieved. But in September, though, there was an incident. I woke up one morning. I kept my Geiger on all the time. I woke up one morning, and my Geiger went up to 0.4 microsieverts per hour. I mean, you know, that was the measurement I just gave you from Belarus. We're just a little bit under.
Yeah, but that's a lot.
And it carried on all day. The next day, it dropped down to 0.3. The next day, it dropped down to 0.2. Now, of course, I was wondering where this was coming from. So I went on to EuroDep, and I saw that there was some issue. And that was coming from Hungary, where they've got where the IAEA has their European, the main European medical isotope factory, a reactor, basically. And they pull out basically iodine and, you know, various other isotopes for medical use, and they chuck the rest out. Now, there was some problem with the Hungary. It was reported by CRIRAD, a French oversight charity on nuclear matters. And they were in Fukushima as well, by the way. So basically, they did a report on this release that was done from Hungary. And once again, they were talking about the fact that, you know, according to all the monitoring statistics and what have you, that Belarus only put out so many terabecquerels of radiation per year. But they were saying, you know, it's much higher because this particular incident actually polluted the area around Budapest. You know, so all the milk and everything was contaminated with a different type of iodine. I think it was iodine 132. I may be wrong here, but it was another iodine anyway. And it lasted, the actual iodine, I know it would be a contaminant for 2 years. Now, the iodine 131 is a contaminant only for about 3 months. So this was still quite a pokey iodine that was released. Now, but at that time, when that happened, I was getting these 0.4 microsieverts readings. Now, that aside, you know, after about 3 or 4 days, it got down to sort of more normal levels. So in the UK, this was in London, it got down to lower levels. Now, I reported this on Any News. We picked up on it. We did studies, and we contacted the IAEA. We did lots of things. And the IAEA would basically deny it. Initially, they said, no, it's from Fukushima. No, it's from Pakistan. And then eventually, because, you know, CRIRAD and other people were on the case, they said, oh, yeah, it was from Hungary, but it wasn't that bad. Right. Now, bearing in mind that London is about 1,500 miles, maybe a bit more, from Budapest. So basically, this probably, I don't know how it got down there, whether it went down through the Med, came back heading east, and then came up and hit the UK. I don't know how it got there, because I haven't seen similar reports in other European countries. So there's one of two things had occurred. Now, about a little bit later, I was looking around for lead issues, mm-hmm. and I was doing a pollution watch thing, and I found one report by an American airbase in the UK, which basically said that their water had been contaminated by lead to over the limit. It was just over the limit, but it was notifiable. But the thing is, though, is that this particular report had been deleted off the internet, and I did a Google cache on it, and I got the actual all the details, and I put it onto nuclear-news.net. So I discovered that there's this lead was actually polluting the area. And then, of course, in 2012, there was a report by the RSPCA, the RSPBA, sorry, the Royal Society for Protection of Birds, anyway. So basically, they put a report out that there was unusually high levels of lead found in birds, and they were very they couldn't work out why, because lead shot wasn't being used. They got rid of that in the UK. They got rid of lead paint. You know, lead was, you know, they got rid of all the lead piping, you know, so they couldn't work out where this lead was coming from the birds. Of course, I think I know where it's come from. Now, the interesting thing here is two scenarios. One is it came from Hungary with that radiation. Or two, there was another release done by Sellafield or somewhere similar that decided to use that as a cover to release.
Did other... you go online and look to see if there was any nuclear facilities or manufacturers near you?
Well, it's not so much near me. The nearest one to me was, you know, basically was miles and miles away, you know. But the bottom line is, though, is that since then I discovered that I then started getting onto nitrogen dioxide, the nitrogen oxides pollution. And that kills 30,000 people a year in the UK. Now, I started getting Geiger counters going up. So I got up to 0.2, 0.25. And then I'd go on the internet, I'd look for the pollution levels, and lo and behold, NO2 would be high in the area I was. And it got to one point where I actually was able to track it. I've put this all on my YouTube channel. It was about 6 months worth of, or just a bit over that, 6 months or so of
I think I remember following that. That was about 14, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. No, that was in 2012.
Yeah, so when I first got involved in this, that's right.
I think it started in 2011, but I really got going in 2012. And I did about, it was about 6 or 7, 8 months. Yeah, it was 2012, that's right, because the Olympics was on. And I did it during that time. And I kept picking up all this NO2. And then one particular time, I was looking at the national NO2 monitoring system. And I was getting quite high levels. And I put it up on my YouTube, but... there was also, and I also put up the maps showing that between Sellafield and London, every single one of the NO2 areas were being lit up, all right, all the way from Sellafield to London. And at that point, I worked out that Sellafield, which was making, what they do is they put the fuel rods into, and other nuclear waste, into nitric acid as a process. And then they scoop off all the plutonium and stuff they want. And then they back up all the rest. But this creates NO2. So what I discovered was is that the NO2 also comes with radon and other bits and bobs, particulates. And that was what I was picking up in London. And that's what was triggering the NO2. And it, within that, you know, if you've got radon, then you're not far away from getting lead as an end process. If you're getting particulates plus radon, you're getting the radon chain, and lead is one part of that radon chain.
Yeah? Well, Sean, do you mind if I ask you a question, though? I thought Sellafield was closed down.
No, not at all, no. No, it's very much open. There's lots of money to be made by the nuclear industry there at the moment.
It's actually still doing what it was assigned to do. It's still...
I mean they've stopped making MOX fuel. Because Mark, I think it was funnily enough, straight after Fukushima, you know, Unit 3 had the biggest bang.
What's Fellside Power Station and nuclear power plant right there?
Where's what, sorry?
Fellside Power Station.
Well, there is a, I think there is a nuclear reactor on site.
Yeah, that's called Fellside.
Yeah, they've got, as I say, they've got various processes going on there, you know. So it's they actually want to build another, I think it's 2 nuclear reactors there as well.
Objections, that's probably you.
well, in fact, actually, that's the Irish government actually sort of saying, you're having a laugh, aren't you? And there are a lot. I mean, the thing is that in Ireland, it's against the constitution to have nuclear power or nuclear weapons. You know, so Ireland's come, it's a net neutral country. They don't really want to have anything to do with that side of things. Saying that, they're not perfect, but that's another discussion. But I think, you know, to a degree, the nuclear industry has Ireland by the short and curlies.
According to Wikipedia, the studies on Cumbria and Cumbria in Seascale says that there's no evidence of raised health, no evidence of cancer increases, no evidence.
Sure, sure. Well, there is evidence, but what they say, it's down to viruses. I think the latest one is it's down to viruses. They tried this about 15, 20 years ago, and it got just booted out. But they're saying, oh, no, it's viruses because of population mixing. That's what's causing the leukemias in children. But these are all the sort of little games that are played by the nuclear industry.
The government of the Isle of Man is also registered protests. There's a government of the Isle of Man.
That's right, yeah. They're actually technically a separate country. But it's a sort
they
of
are?
thing. Well, it's a tax dodge thing. They're actually you. It's a royal. You know, the Queen is in charge, but they're a tax dodge. So a lot of companies go there and use it as a way of getting around the tax you know, doing tax evasion and getting around sort of UK laws and things. So it's there's just you know, the Isle of Man has its own little niche there. It's a bit like Jersey and the Bahamas and all that kind of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, they're right on the forefront, the Isle of Man. But you know, the nuclear industry is very powerful. They're very convinced.
There's something weird. My maiden name is Moody Man, and my understanding is that my ancestors came from there.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised they left. Actually, they were lucky. You were all lucky.
They were kind of scoundrels, frankly. From what we don't know. There's different stories. There's sure. different stories of who. Some say they were came with a circus, and some say they were indentured servants.
Okay, so yes. Well, you think they were sort of travelers or something?
Well, they ran away and went south to Texas, so they were kind of the scoundrel people. You know, it's interesting.
I think in those days, everybody was a scoundrel, and technically, you know, and nowadays it's only the bankers that are scoundrels.
Well, so. Nowadays they're just called rednecks. No offense, rednecks out there. Anyways, let me double check the time. It sure has gone fast, Sean. We have we've got about 7 minutes left. So this is interesting how this all ties in together. I mean, this is the we can talk about all. This is the thing. We can talk about all the facts, but here's the Irish government. Here's these little tiny governments saying no, 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 and the nuclear industry just bullies its way through and has done it. What we need is we need people who can handle nuclear waste. We need a whole industry surrounding nuclear waste, not nuclear power. Nuclear power needs to be shut down.
I agree.
And that is where we must, that's what has to happen. We can't demonize it because guess what? We're sitting in a stew of it.
Sure.
You know, have you seen that movie called Astro Boy? It's a kid movie.
I've heard of it. I haven't seen
it. You should watch it. Because that is exactly what they want. That's, in fact, where they're turning us into. And I think what that movie was about was, like, grooming kids to accept that as normal. I watched it with my little neighbor friend.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, in the UK, they've started a huge sort of the nuclear industry have started. They started it a few years ago now. They got lots of money from the government to go into schools and say how wonderful nuclear power was, and not give any of the downsides, only give the upsides. And at the same time, they were targeting activists for persecution. Very much going back to the original story about hacking. Because the NSA obviously are very much connected with GCHQ in the UK, they're the equivalent. And GCHQ, according to Edward Snowden, who I mentioned at the start of the program, basically are worse than, you know, the worst users.
That's
and
what
abusers.
I understand. That's
yeah,
what my
they're the worst users
is.
And abusers of this type of software. Yeah. I mean, the Stasi.
Actually, wasn't it like GCHQ and the German government, the spies from the German government who informed the White House about Donald Trump's like friends sitting in with Russian spies and that whole thing.
Well, you know, I mean, once again, you go into the world of intelligence, it's all smoke and mirrors, you know, in my books.
Who knows what, who's what, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, it's all obviously a little game that they're messing with our heads. This is the thing.
Sure. I mean, for me,
this is why it's important for us just to talk about what the issues are and how we can stop it. Like, I was really proud of the Belgians. I thought that was right on. You know, locking arms and arms and going, nope.
Yeah, no, it's hands-on activism, and it's up to us to promote those stories and tell people that these things are happening. And you know, of course, if we look around the world, you know, we're seeing pushback in South Korea to nuclear and all sorts of places, you know, where you know, and even in Russia. We're seeing pushback to nuclear power. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very slow process. We're seeing the Chinese, they're investing more in renewables than nuclear power by by magnitudes of billions of dollars or yen or whatever. So at the end of the day, we're nuclear industry, I think, is coming to an end. Obviously, I think it will be the taxpayer that will be left holding the smouldering mess that's left at the end. And I think we have to give nuclear workers some support, because they're the guys that
we need nuclear. Donna Gilmore coined that phrase. That's what I heard her say at first, is we need nuclear waste specialists. This is really, it's true. We don't need nuclear scientists. We need us to come clean with it. We need to figure it out. We need to stop being ridiculously childish about it all.
Sure. I'm an engineer. I'm vehemently anti-nuclear power and anti-nuclear weapons, without a doubt. I'll have other ecological things that I'm into as well. I don't like the way the mining industry operates and various other things. But the bottom line is that in terms of cleanup, we need competent people who are going to be able to manage this waste, collect it up, put it in one place, not stick it in boreholes where they're doing fracking and all this kind of stuff. That's my kind of way of dealing with it. As a taxpayer, I'm willing to pay a bit more if they're willing to deal with this nuclear waste in a sensible way, as opposed to doing it in the cheap way that they're trying to. They're trying to bury it in boreholes.
It's not cheap, but see, that ends up being so much more expensive in the long run. This is one thing where if you pay on the front end, it's way less expensive and way less harmful on the far end. This is going to be a 100-year process if we're going to be real, 100,000-year process.
Well, if we don't get on top
of it. Project out as a species, each of us carry our weight 100 years in advance, because that's pretty much all we can deal with until someone comes up with something smart. Sure. But it has to be real. Have about 2 minutes left.
Just to finish off quickly, I would say, like the UK at the moment, the reason why they're trying to push fracking is not to get gas. It's actually to bury nuclear waste. That's my little takeaway point. And I would say one other thing. I've done a couple of interviews with Chris Busby. I'm still processing one of them. Great. But the other one is on ArcLight 2011 on YouTube. That's ArcLight 2011 on YouTube. I've put that up today. So that's quite an interesting little update.
This is a new one. I'll see that on my subscriptions today.
Sure, sure.
Awesome.
It was a great little interview. It only goes on for 35 minutes or so. There is another one that's going to be put up on that channel soon as well. I think Libby's going to be taking some of that as well. And Chris is involved with USS Ronald Reagan. He's involved with another.
I would love to interview him again when he has time. The last time I asked him, he said he didn't have time. Haven't either, so... congratulations on that. That's really awesome.
Yeah, he's been really busy. He's been taking the nuclear industry to court and battling away. As I said, he's involved with the USS Reagan case, which seems like it's going ahead. Although I would say, in the paperwork, I don't know if you've read the paperwork, it actually says one little sentence, judgment expressed in very muted terms, if we think. It says, quote, we affirm the district court's denial of TEPCO's motion to dismiss. That's the case to be held in USA. As the case develops more fully, however, the district court may reconsider dismissal as a matter of comity or under the political question doctrine or state law. So at the moment, it looks like the case
will be
held in the USA. But they do have that little get out, possibly, where there's a few reasons why they may dismiss the case and send it to Japan. But anyway, hopefully it seems to be going ahead. And Chris is one of the people that's going to be fighting as an expert witness for that case.
Thank goodness he's there.
He didn't expect
them to say we'll dismiss it. You know what I mean? Like, for real, they're going to fight tooth and nail.
Oh, absolutely. They have the GE and TEPCO. But in reality, of course, they're taking TEPCO, which has an office in USA, and they're also taking GE, which is from the USA. So the USA is certainly the place that it should be held, that case, you know. But the info is that it's now open. So anyway, he talks a little bit about it in the YouTube video I did. He can't mention much, obviously, because obviously it's an ongoing case. He does talk about some of the other things that we've been doing. So you can tune into that. And so that's
my... Well, that's really great. Well, look, we'll end here. I really appreciate your time. And thanks, Sean. And you've been listening to Sean McGee, who's ArcLight 2011 on YouTube, and really a writer for nuclearnews.net.